These are comments on Taiyake Alfred's Peace, Power, and Righteousness, which is from the early 2000s, and Bonfi Batalla's Mexico Profundo from the middle of the 1990s. These are quite different projects, but I think they're really complementary. I don't think they contradict one another, except on maybe one or two points, which I'll identify. And I think at least in broad strokes, they're saying very similar things. Taiyake Alfred is a Mohawk, and Bonfi Batalla is a Mexican writer, and they are talking about the areas that they're familiar with. So Taiyake has worked with indigenous groups across North America, and especially in Canada, and he's based outside of Montreal in Iroquois territory. He's a Mohawk. And then Batalla is talking about, he's talking about Mexico. We're talking about most of the Americas, but not today South America, really. Okay, so what are they talking about? Well, they're talking about the problem that we looked at, we've looked at repeatedly, of indigenous peoples being submerged under colonial structures. And they're discussing the process by which these local indigenous groups do or do not come back into their power, and the way that contemporary colonial apparatuses or the contemporary nation state grabs onto these localities, tries to keep them separated, tries to mediate their relations itself, and ultimately really wants to absorb their governance into its own system. And it's even willing, especially in the late 20th century, to grant things that are called self-government to indigenous groups, provided that that government follows Western guidelines, that it has a Western form, and most importantly, that it integrates into the large-scale federal structure appropriate to Canada or the United States or Mexico. This is the situation that exists for indigenous people across the Americas, and I think Batalla would like to suggest that the indigenous peoples are really broader than the peoples who are simply called indigenous, because all kinds of Mexican culture emerges from Mesoamerica, and even when there are peoples who have sprung biologically both from indigenous groups and from European groups, still in important, significant ways, aspects of their everyday life, of what they eat, of how they treat one another, of the norms and morals of their collectivities, of their languages, or the ways that their languages are inflected, their religion, even if it's, say, Mexico Catholicism, is heavily inflected by indigenous practices, right? Indigeneity, the continuation of Mesoamerica, exists for many groups across Mexico, maybe nearly all of them, except for the dominant elites who have opted to be as European as possible, who have taken up the European model every which way, in their dress, in their manner of life, in their valuations, and so on. And this, of course, is the problem. So there's a duality between the Western colonial project in its current manifestations, which Batalla will call imaginary Mexico. He means that there is a vision, a modernizing Western vision, in terms of which and on behalf of which the present rulers of Mexico and of its localities operate. But it's not really characteristic of everyday life for the mass of Mexican people. There's a difference between this Western civilization and the thing that it has laid down on top of. And the project is to bring the underclass, the localities, Mesoamerica, which still continues in everyday life and at regular, everyday, small-scale locations, to bring it back into some kind of state of flourishing. This is also what Taiyake Alfred wants. So in Peace, Power, Righteousness, which is subtitled An Indigenous Manifesto, he's largely trying to diagram what are the relationships between indigenous governance and the colonial machinery. And he observes at the very beginning that there is a split through indigenous society itself between those who want to maintain traditional practices and manners of governance and those, on the other hand, who have accepted this notion of modernization, including financialization, transformation of culture into an acquisitive and consumer culture, and adaptation of Canadian United States style Western models of governance. This split runs through these communities. And for Alfred, he doesn't quite use this language. Well, he doesn't use it as much in Peace, Power, Righteousness as he will a little bit later in Wazase. But the goal is called resurgence. The idea is to identify those aspects of indigenous life which are still alive, which are healthy, which seem like, in certain ways, they could be a very important counterbalance or even solution to Western values and practices, which have led to global warming and ecological devastation, not to mention racialism and the subjugation of all kinds of populations. It seems like there's something desirable about the indigenous principles of governance, so he wants to identify those, emphasize those, and put them in touch with a practice which would actively try to supplant, to displace colonial control and put in place indigenous control, not just nominally, not just fielding some group of representatives from a particular occupied territory who are then going to integrate with the colonial elite and perhaps eventually confuse themselves with that elite, but rather a set of principles and practices that are based in traditional life that can be resurged, regathered, recollected, and re-implemented in contemporary circumstances. They both agree on this project of rebuilding from the communities, from the indigenous communities, from their indigeneity, from the philosophy or the principles which are central and appropriate to that indigeneity, and connecting this with activism in such a fashion that the power of these communities really grows. The democratic power of these communities really grows. Okay, so looking at these key texts, Bataille and Alfred, what is the critique of Western systems of governance and systems of economy and systems of practice and systems of values? Their claim is that the Western governance model is based on coercion and authoritarianism. It's based on hierarchy. And the claim that we'll see in a couple of these texts and also in Anzaldúa is that this dominating tendency of the colonizers is rooted, for one thing, and maybe most importantly, in their relationship to nature. Now, this relationship to nature is a relationship of domination. On the Western view and the Western tradition, at least by the time it hits so-called modernity, but really for the Christian period as well, the world is outside me, and largely speaking, it is dead. What matters is only inside me. I am a soul, and I can be saved, and that's what's ultimately real. Now, you can find this in Christianity, which says that the earth is there to be dominated by humans, that it is a gift from God to people, to use, and even more specifically, to make fruitful. So this is something often referred to by capitalists and doubly referred to by capitalists in the period of colonization. One of the reasons that the United States gave as it expanded west for taking over indigenous lands was, oh, well, you know, they're not using it anyway. That is, they are not clear-cutting, setting up rectilinear fields, and producing for an international market. They are not causing the land to become maximally productive for exchange in an economy. And because they're not doing that, they're inferior. And somebody who's superior, which is part of the Western matrix of thought, their own superiority, is in their rights to take this land. That relationship to the land that says you must dominate it, you must cause it to produce as much wealth as possible, is already there in Christian doctrine through the period of the Middle Ages in Europe. This relationship that says humans are one thing, the rest of the world is something else, humans are in charge, the rest of the world is below them. This is typical of the West. And then, of course, it gets amplified when we come to, say, Descartes. Descartes is about 1640, who claims that everything outside of humans is nothing but a machine, really. That we alone have some kind of soul or mind attached to our body, but even the highest other animals are really nothing but sophisticated machines. And then, of course, the Cartesian view reduces everything to geometry and mechanism. This also is typical of Western society. It's based on domination. And it also involves, here's Anzaldúa again, it involves suppression of the body, suppression of sexuality, and suppression of women. These are all things that are typical of the Western European society that expanded and colonized so much of the rest of the world. It is, as Alfred says, a destructive and disrespectful paradigm, a destructive and disrespectful society, which in its application deliberately separates people from one another, deliberately disconnects people from their traditions, disconnects people from their land, disconnects people from their languages, disconnects people from their traditional modes of governance, disconnects people from their traditional modes of religion, and disconnects local groups from other local groups. Now, Bataille would jump in here and say, actually, that's interesting how the Mexican state, even as it becomes nominally independent, 1810, 1860, 1910 to 1920, in each of these periods, it's always aiming at a Western modernizing goal. It wants to get more technology, more production, more centralization, a more homogenized and accessible labor force to get maximum production out of the land. Whichever of these pivotal moments in Mexican history we're talking about, we're going to see the same urge. This program isolates local communities, but it also has a certain interest in keeping them Indian, because it's only insofar as they remain Indian that their subjugation and the external administration of their lands continues to be justified. So at the same time that this colonization breaks apart the societies upon which it is applied, it also constructs the localities, the isolated, alienated localities, which nevertheless continue in some form and to some degree to practice the ways of life, ways of decision-making, usages of land, and so on, which are pre-colonial. So they're subjugated. Pre-colonial life is subjugated, but it is not destroyed. It is maintained in little pockets. And both Alfred and Bataille primarily are seeking the resurgence of these cultures, beliefs, principles, especially principles, forms of reconnection. This is what they want. They want reconnection between people, between local groups, between people and their languages, between people and their traditional modes of governance, which does not mean in either case that they want to go back to some pre-colonial time, because it's kind of impossible to see how that would happen, but rather they want to reinvigorate these principles and re-empower the people whose ancestry those principles are, so as to be able to act and organize themselves on this traditional basis in today's world, to apply these principles to real problems and real relationships and real infrastructures as they exist today. So this is not about going back to some romanticized state of nature. This is about identifying different ways of life, some of them as preferable, and some of them as really problematic, choosing the preferable, and then trying to mount a program that would be based on these preferable principles. So I've just listed off some of the aspects of the colonial society. Let me finish that off, and then I'll go on and talk about the better values that both of these writers think they clearly perceive in indigenous life valuation and practice. Colonization deliberately separated people in all these ways that I've listed. It also set up racial distinctions. It brought race. It called certain people Indians, and it called other people slaves. And then it distinguished between these groups, right? It set up racial hierarchies depending on the amount of blood one had that was indigenous or European, right? Race was established through European colonialism. And then there's an ideology that goes along with this colonialism. And this is the ideology that was adopted, for example, in Mexico by elites in 1810, 1860, even in the 1920s when the Mexican Revolution is complete and we have this period of kind of socialism in Mexico. Bataille points out even socialist projects are still not re-indigenizing. They're still a part of the overall structure and the overall value system of the colonizing West. So what is the ideology of this colonizing system? Well, it talks about development, and it talks about progress, and it talks about advancement. And it says stuff about democracy, but probably the democracy that it sets up is fake. Now, each one of these things, the development and progress and advancement, in ways, the values are contradicted by the practices. But really, the thing that is problematic about them is that they all imply a goal. Development, progress, advancement, and even the revolution, the revolutionary goals still rest on these notions of development, progress, and advancement. And those goals, what are they? Well, they're economic expansion, technological increase, and ultimately state and capitalist goals. The capitalist goal is endless accumulation of value, which also means endless accumulation of domination and endless accumulation of monetary value or wealth on the basis of domination. And then there's a state goal, a typically state goal, which is unification. This is something that Bataille is particularly concerned with, but which clearly has operated throughout the Americas upon indigenous people. Indigenous people were put into boarding schools where their languages were beaten out of them, right? They were given English names instead of their Indian names. They were beaten for using their language or using their own names. There was an attempt to homogenize the existing population. This is true in Mexico as well. The state's goal is to unify the territory and the people, to put it under the control of a certain administrative and militaristic center, to homogenize the entire state space so as to facilitate administration. Okay, these are the goals, and these are goals imported from elsewhere, both of them say. Now, what are the characteristics of indigenous society and indigenous governance through this massive region? Well, they're non-state societies. This is more true of North America than it is of the Aztecs or the Mayans and the Incans. But even in those cases, there's less distinction between leaders and people. And the rule across North America is that there is no distinction between leaders and people. No ranked distinction. It's not like leaders don't have to work anymore. They have to hunt, they have to farm, just like everybody else. They're not treated as a different sort of people, and they do not live off the surplus of others. This is one way in which the Aztec and the Incan empires are distinct, are exceptions to the rest of this world. But the general rule is no central authority, real democracy. Now, why could Bataille call the democracy that is brought in the name of progress by Western colonialism, why could he call that democracy fake? Well, I think we've looked at this. The easiest reason is because this democracy only takes place for a very small group of people. This small group of people are called the representatives of everyone else, and then democracy happens by these representatives and then expresses itself in a powerful, top-down, forcible implementation of its decisions. That's fake democracy or problematic democracy, and really not democracy at all, because it excludes the mass of people. And if we look carefully, we'll even see that the processes of the selection of representatives are corrupt and are problematic. But the main point is that everyday people have nothing to do with this stuff. Just like everyday people have very little to do with modernization and technological development. In everyday life, there remains, though, Bataille says, and Taiyake says, there remains practices of democracy on a small and local scale. And what needs to happen is that those practices need to be rejuvenated, empowered, and expanded. So these are non-state societies, and they're real democratic societies. Go back and check out Sachs, for example, if you want a listing off of the North American groups and considerations of their modes of participatory government. Even if you look at the Iroquois this week, they do have a body of representatives, a formalized group of chiefs, sachems, who are put in place by women nobles, and they make decisions, right? So they have a specialized governmental apparatus, but they're also a dual power system where there's a continuation of local council fires, that's assemblies, local council fires for each village, for each clan, for each tribe, for each nation, and even of the entirety of all the six nations. They can all form their own assemblies, and these assemblies ultimately have more power than the official chiefs who make official decisions. And of course, when the United States copies portions of its constitution from the Iroquois constitution, it copies only the formalized aspect, but it pays no attention to the structure of council fires, which counterbalances this. And then lastly, these societies are societies of equality, radical equality. They are aggressively, militantly egalitarian, which also explains why they insist upon collective decision-making oriented towards consensus. Okay, so the goal is to push back this colonial structure and to resurge the modes of governance that the colonial structure was placed over. Now, let me step aside for a second and point out that I'm not indigenous. I'm not from this land. You know, my people have been here a couple hundred years, I suppose. It would be really weird for me to claim indigeneity. If I'm indigenous anywhere, it's in maybe Ireland or something. And yet, I do think that there is something for me and people like me to gather from these texts and to support from these texts. And the thing that can be gathered is, hey, look, here are political principles and ecological principles and economic principles, which seem to be very different than the problematic ones which dominate us today. You know, it's not only indigenous people who have been separated, who have been proletarianized, who have been placed in a situation of dependence, which Bataille points to as, or is it Taiaike? One of them points to as the fundamental evil of these systems, that they make us dependent for food. We can't live unless we integrate into the system. This is their preliminary violence. We are all in that situation, not just indigenous people. And so I think that we can look at indigenous societies, which were run along very different lines than this expansionary colonial European society. We can look at these other societies and learn from them and say, hey, oh yeah, maybe real freedom, real autonomy of the individual, real autonomy of the locality, real autonomy of the nation, and so on, is preferable to imposed dependence that is kept in place by raw material force, by the police. Maybe this is desirable. Maybe it's preferable. And then we could say, okay, I would like to implement something like that. Let me learn something from these older peoples who have deeper roots in a past that was healthy. Now, of course, it's not that we can return to a romantic state of nature where everything was fine, but perhaps if we were to act on the basis of principles that seem to be superior to the European ones, if we can identify what are the problems of the colonial system and what are the opposite of those problems, what are the solutions to those problems? In many ways, reconnection is the solution to disconnection. Maybe we can look at these indigenous groups and say, okay, we want to learn from you and we want to support you and we want to do things sort of like you. And this opens up a whole new territory of questions, which I would really like to discuss, about what about those of us who are not indigenous? What is our group? What is our community? And if this community is already broken apart or just kind of irredeemably a part of the colonial apparatus, perhaps we need to build new communities. This can be done. It has been done. But the question is, along what lines? According to what principles? How shall we organize ourselves into a community? What practices should we habituate such that we have a community which is a good one, which, you know, maybe adopts the principles that Taiaike gives us of respect, reciprocity? What would that look like if it was a feature of a new community? And how can such a community be in solidarity with the other communities, indigenous or not, who are also abiding by these preferable principles? This is the set of questions which I think we have to deal with right now. So, okay, how do we get to resurgence or to pluralism as Bataille lays it out? Oh, and let me make one passing comment. I think the primary difference that I see, at least in these books, between Alfred and Bataille is that Alfred is focused entirely upon the rejuvenation, the re-empowerment of indigenous nations. And I think he thinks that the confederative structures that already existed in North America, and which in some respects even endure loosely today, are sufficient for a broad mechanism for allowing the integration, or rather the working together, the mutual respect and acceptance of different local groups, and even for overcoming conflicts between them. But Bataya, and this is a peculiar thing, and I think, you know, maybe I would have to know more about Mexican culture and society and history, or have been in that to fully grasp it. But Bataya, strangely, and like the Zapatistas, also strangely, from my perspective, they're still supporters of the Mexican state. They still want there to exist a Mexican state, but they want to severely weaken it. Rather, they want to decentralize it. And maybe one of the reasons that they see the necessity for a Mexican state is because of the presence on their northern border for 1,800 miles of this predatory capitalist state machine. Maybe they think they cannot defend themselves without some kind of state to do so. But what Bataya wants, he calls pluralism, which is, to me, you know, about the same as what Alfred wants, which is local self-determination, implementation of local democratic, participatory, consensus-oriented decision-making at all of these different locations, and a mutual respect between these different groups. You know, we talked about how communities and solidarity seem to be based upon commonalities, and we can ask, well, if we allow that a whole bunch of different sectors of a particular territory speak different languages, have different cultures and different religions, isn't that going to run us into difference and therefore war? Tayayake thinks not. The commonality that would exist, and I think Bataya thinks this way too, the commonality that would exist across these different groups with different religious practices, different languages, and so on, is a commonality of respect, a mutual wish for acceptance and tolerance and inclusion. And of course, that's one of the values that the Westerners claim they advance. But of course, in practice, they do the opposite. So both want to resurge the autonomy of local peoples. And that autonomy is based in long historical practice, thousands of years of historical practice, where the individual is given a whole lot of individual autonomy, kids are given autonomy, and local groups are given autonomy. And autonomy means self-determination, right? So they can engage in processes of decision-making that are larger than them, that involve people or peoples beyond their own people and peoples, and come to decisions, but they retain their autonomy even afterwards. They can step out of those decisions. There is no coercive force which is going to make them do what they agreed to do. The autonomy cannot be given away. Alfred says this, you know, the Western model that says, we can take our powers and alienate them into a state. This is the whole like Hobbesian social contract story, right? I'm going to take the portion of my power which could possibly hurt you, and I'm going to hand it over to a cop and a king who are going to wield it over all of us and keep us in line, because we're a bunch of, you know, argumentative, fighty people. Alfred's like, we don't want that. That's not really possible. Let's not have that. The power of peoples, including their capacity and their right and their practice and their habituation and their training for self-defense, has to be kept intact. We need autonomy on every front. So how do you go about getting this? Well, there's a mental dimension, which they both mention, which is that we have to question. We have to question the central values that we're given, especially the values of endless acquisition and consumption. And we got to question the structure that we are part of, particularly its centralization and its hierarchical character. We got to start by defamiliarizing what we're a part of. And I think comparing the Western model, you know, the state democracies, to the non-state democracies, nominal freedom and equality versus real freedom and equality in the indigenous world, we can begin to defamiliarize the system of which we are a part by these comparisons, right? And then you have to identify these principles, think through which are the principles that are good, that are coming from the pre-colonial world, and then you have to figure out how in each one of these autonomous groups to apply those principles in present circumstances. The ultimate goal is to revitalize traditions and ways of life, ways of living that have been suppressed. And specifically, I think this means that we have to engage in a whole bunch of reconnecting to land, reconnecting to tradition, reconnecting to languages, even, to come back to Anzal Dua, reconnection of men and women, you know, a re-equalization of men and women, which means the coming back into existence of a respect, but even reconnection with our own bodies and our own sexuality. Because if we look at the history, she says even the history of the Aztec state takeover from earlier Aztec society, but then especially in the imposition of Western Catholicism in Mexico, these systems have subjugated women, but they've also demonized sexuality. In fact, they even demonized every religious practice that was not Christian. So every practice that existed in the Americas of coming into some kind of communication and communion with special places and with other forms of life, which seem like really important ecological practices, and you know, even scientific approaches might say, yes, you can communicate with other forms of life. Every one of these practices, the attempts to defend particular sacred places, practices that used plants, that involved a whole bunch of knowledge of plants, every one of these practices was deemed devilry by the Europeans. For the real story here, check out Silvia Federici, Caliban and the Witch, or for the fuller story, rather. Everything that wasn't Christian was called devilish. It was all witchcraft, and it was all attacked. And so perhaps one of the things that can be gotten back through a process of resurgence or the development of a pluralistic Mexico, the resurgence of Mexico Profundo, the deep Mexico that is still there in everyday practices, perhaps this resurgence could also involve a reconnection with our own selves, with our own deeper selves, the parts of us that are irrational or not immediately apparent and conscious, our continuity with the material world. This is like the Dionysian, right? Maybe we could even get new forms of perception and new forms of living out of these massive changes. But it seems that even for non-indigenous people, some kind of changes like this are necessary.